accountability. It's a word we hear a lot around Libya, but what does it mean? Why does it matter? And how do we even begin to get close to it? To begin to make sense of it a little, our guest today is Carla Firstman, senior lecturer at the University of Essex and former head of redress, and personally, one of the most terrifyingly knowledgeable people on international human rights law and international criminal law that I've ever met. Listen out for how you can bring someone to justice just by walking through the airport. Enjoy the episode.
I'm here with my co-host Marwa.
Hello.
And with our wonderful guest, Carla Firstman.
Hi, it's great to be here.
It's so wonderful to have you here. The thing we've been talking about a lot, and we are guilty of using a lot. We even have a hashtag on most of our Twitter, I was about to say Twitter statements, that's how out of touch I am, tweets, is accountability. So I really wanted to explore what is meant by that and how we make that a thing in Libya. And so maybe I'll throw that out first. What do we mean when we say accountability?
Well, for me, accountability, it's kind of a word that doesn't have so much attached to it. So it's one of those words that you can think of it in a range of different contexts. But for me, the heart of what it means is trust. So you can think of a public institution. How is a public institution if it's transparent, if it is very clear what it's doing? So their transparency makes it clear what the organization is doing, which then results in people being able to trust what the institution says and what it does. For a government, accountability can be about punishment. If people do something wrong, we want to know that the legal system works. We want to make sure that it works transparently, but also without bias. So it's often a case of, well, if someone commits a crime, we want to know that the same thing is going to happen to them, regardless of who they are, whether they're someone with a lot of money or a lot of power or from a particular family. We want to know that the consequences are going to be the same because the system of justice is accountable and transparent.
So is accountability then like a prerequisite for the rule of law, or is it a consequence of the rule of law?
Well, I would say accountability is the broad concept, which includes transparency and fairness. And for there to be a rule of law, you would want to make sure that the overall system of justice works fairly. It works for everyone. You want to know that someone who has suffered a crime or has been hurt, that they can go to a public office and explain what happened, and that the officials, whoever they are, whatever they look like, whatever tribe they are or whatever religion, that they'll get the same treatment because they suffered a crime. So that's really important for accountability. We can think in a criminal justice context that accountability is much smaller, that it's about the result, but I see it more about the process, which includes the result.
Okay, so we've touched a little bit about what we mean by criminal accountability and explored a little bit about this idea that it's somehow very intrinsic to what we think is as the rule of law in a wider sense. So do you have to have a legal element for accountability? Is the law required for accountability?
Well, yes, because if a society is run by laws, then we need to make sure that the laws are respected. And if laws are only respected for certain people or in certain contexts, then that would be a problem. So the enforcement of laws, whatever those laws might be, whether they're criminal laws or civil laws, or you're not allowed to litter on the streets, or you have to obey the speed limit in your car. All of these types of ways that people live in a society that has mutual respect and trust, to me, is part of accountability.
Is there an ethical element to it?
I suppose when I think about government and public officials, there is an ethical element to how public officials need to operate in the public interest. So to me, that has a strong ethical component.
Okay, so if we were to take this now a little bit further in the context of Libya, where we are looking at a breakdown in the rule of law, in the judiciary, in the implementation of any form of legal codes, how then do we translate this idea or the abstract idea first of accountability in Libya as it is today?
Well, if you think about governance at the first basic level as a contract between the people and those who are governing. So at the very basic level, it's almost like the constitution, how there's a relationship between the people who are a part of a society and those who have the role of enforcing the law. So that relationship between the governed and those who are governing is really important at a very basic level. And then we can look at different areas and how governance should look. And to me, that's at the heart of accountability, regardless of the sphere that you look at. So if you think about the absence of the rule of law, which is something which, as you say, can be applied to Libya. So the first thing is to look at, well, what are the basic, most fundamental laws in Libya, and identifying what it is that they say and what are the barriers to the enforcement of those laws. Sometimes laws don't work because some people feel that the laws don't apply to them, or there's a gap in implementation, or sometimes the people who are the victims don't feel like they really deserve implementation of the law, so they don't even seek protection. So we can look at it from different angles. One, an abuse of power with respect to the contract between the average citizen in a country and those governing them. And abuse of power, meaning that the governments or certain officials think that they're above the law. And then we can also look at it at the grassroots level. Some communities, some people within communities somehow either don't understand, don't believe, or feel embarrassed or unable, for whatever reason, to use the law, to seize it as theirs, to see it as theirs to be implemented.
Or also the element of trust that you mentioned before, that there isn't that trust between them and these institutions that are meant to protect them, right? So one of the things we see is victims don't almost see the point of engaging with a legal process because it's seen as only serving a certain class of people.
You think a victim, what is a victim but a person with a series of lived experiences? So if you think about a person who's grown up in a certain context, who has grown up with stories about their family and aspects that may have happened to their family in the past, and has their own experience going through life, whether as a young person, as a student, someone trying to get employment, someone having medical issues or whatever. Those day-to-day experiences, how a person engages with the outside world and engages with government agencies, which are there in principle to support this person, will impact how they see the law.
If we take it back to trying to think, okay, well, if we have this context now where very little of what's available domestically is an option for accountability, and we're also seeing very concrete abuses of people and very concrete impunity in the ground, where do we go to whilst there's nothing available for us in country?
Well, the International Criminal Court has started investigations, as many people in Libya will know.
This makes my heart sink as opposed to giving me a source of hope, but let's carry on.
Well, the UN Security Council referred the situation of Libya at around the time of the fall of the Gaddafi regime. And the way in which the Security Council referred this matter to the International Criminal Court was basically it said, what's happening in Libya is a breach, or there is a problem with international peace and security. So we think that an international court would be relevant to investigate these incidents and also to lead to justice if there's no justice happening locally. But what was interesting about that referral was that the Security Council basically made an open-ended referral. So not only was it possible for the International Criminal Court to, through the Office of the Prosecutor, to start looking at what were the events around the situation of the end of the Gaddafi regime that required investigation, but also all the stuff that's happened subsequently were also able to be looked at. So the prosecutor has, as you know, brought a number of allegations relating to the Gaddafi regime, but has since continued to investigate and has captured in a arrest warrant some of the additional allegations of crimes relating to some of the armed militia groups.
I think that's a very generous interpretation of the Office of the Prosecutor's work. We've only seen one non-Gaddafi era arrest warrant.
Yeah.
It is obviously because it's an arrest warrant. It's targeted at one individual. Your description of the mandate and then the reality makes me feel even more depressed at the work of the court, because in fact they do have this wide mandate, and the prosecutor loves to tell us about how she's investigating trafficking, she's investigating the situation of IDPs, she's investigating the situation of migrants, and really, okay, this is my eternal hope is that there's hundreds of arrest warrants under seal, but the ones that we know about, there's only been one in the last 5 years or 6 years.
I think that's absolutely fair comment. I was trying to give maybe a bit too neutral. Just, this is the mandate. This is what they're doing or starting to do. I hope they continue. But actually, do I hope they continue? Now, that's a good question. Because actually, I would far better hope that the domestic situation in Libya would improve so that there could be prosecutions in Libya. I don't see that in the short term, but would that be better? Absolutely, that would be better, because the International Criminal Court has a powerful mandate but no power, and it hasn't been very capable of managing its power relations, which are necessary in order to get people arrested who are under an arrest warrant transferred to The Hague, and nor has it been possible for it to progress with cases which haven't been supported by states who are party to the ICC statute. So I don't see the ICC as having the strongest ability to... It's not your beacon of hope for justice in Libya, unfortunately, I don't think. But it might be a catalyst. So for the civil society, for the groups who are hoping to see more accountability in Libya, how can you use the fact that the ICC prosecutor has this mandate, that the ICC prosecutor has started to investigate, how can you use that fact to catalyze justice in Libya. Interestingly, I mean, there's a lot of other countries where there is impunity, no justice for really serious crimes. And very, you know, in the same region, let's think about Syria, for instance. So what's interesting about Syria is there was no possibility for there to be a referral to the International Criminal Court. But maybe that was actually a good thing. Because actually what's happened is there have been international investigations, and certain countries have understood that it's their responsibility to arrest people from Syria who are coming into their jurisdiction. So you have Germany, you have the Netherlands, who are starting to arrest persons accused of really serious crimes from Syria. And there is slowly building up a process of justice. Of course, you wouldn't want all the crimes suspects from Libya to be tried in other countries, nor is the politics the same to allow for that. But it's another opportunity, perhaps, if the evidence is there. So there's two aspects there. How is the evidence of crimes being collected? Is it available? Is it trustworthy? Can it be put before an international prosecutor? I would say potentially yes, in relation to certain cases. So what does that need? It needs a lot of coordination. All of those who are in a position to collect information about crimes happening in Libya need to be speaking to each other, collaborating and sharing information. The standards of how they collect information needs to be good, because if you pass information which isn't credible, it means a criminal case is never going to succeed. And one needs to ensure that the right cases are pursued. What does that mean, the right cases? What kind of case is right when there's so much crime? Really difficult question. I'm sure lots of your listeners are going to have very different views about what the right case is. But in my view, I think it's important to think about the scale of criminality, how serious the crimes are, who is being affected, and what prospect a case will have in contributing to the overall sense of accountability that we started off this discussion with.
A lot of very interesting points raised there. In working on this question of accountability for Libya, and trying to push for different mechanisms, trying to get the court involved and interested despite their jurisdiction, it is, I think, like you rightfully pointed out, is that the court's jurisdiction,
the International Criminal Court,
the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction over Libya, oftentimes can pose as an obstacle to other forms of justice. And this, so I think that with the situation in Libya today, the court, the international court, has done very little in terms of, we haven't seen the fruit of their investigations over the past 8 years now, except for the arrest warrant. There were two arrest warrants for Mahmoud Burfani, and it was actually built on evidence from open source media. So he pretty much handed over that one to them.
He created his own evidence. Yeah.
Everything online.
Well, maybe what he has to do now is, you know, get on an airplane and take a visit to The Hague in the Netherlands.
Yeah. But maybe I know this is a really small technical point, but it's something that I'm always asked, is why are there two arrest warrants for one person? What is the point of the court issuing two arrest warrants?
I can't say that I absolutely know on that point. One needs to break it down and look at the charges. Are the charges different? the timing of them. Perhaps the second one expands in terms of information, the rationale for the arrest. But I don't have a clear answer for that.
That was a year after the first arrest warrant.
I think he posted more videos.
Yeah. And then he was supposed to have been arrested and being investigated. And then he posted another video of committing these extrajudicial killings. And then following that, the second arrest warrant came out.
Is he traveling?
We don't know.
We don't know. He doesn't really make many appearances other than ones where he's killing people.
Well, it's a good question, the travel, because often a network of people, including those who work at airports, can be really important to ensure that those in a position to make an arrest know that a person is traveling. People are fallible. An international court, which learns 2 days late that someone they've arrested is in a particular country, might take them 24 hours to put together démarche, some kind of an approach to that government to see whether or not they will surrender the person. And 24 hours might be too late. But if we know that a person is traveling because they've stepped on an airplane which has a 10-hour flight to country X, then that's 10 hours to prepare. That's a great thing. So your readers should all be in touch with you.
Our listeners.
That's right, your listeners should all be in touch with you about people they see in airport lounges.
This all comes back to, again and again, to this concept of political will. And I mean, you said it so clearly, right? It's got a powerful mandate, but no power as a court. And so is there something to be said for us to actually reduce our efforts on the ICC and redirect them perhaps elsewhere if we want to achieve genuine accountability as opposed to symbolic accountability?
If you were in the position to rely on domestic courts at this moment to assert a strong role in bringing justice, then perhaps. Unfortunately, you don't have a long list of options at your hands. You have to use what's available. The International Criminal Court is by no means a perfect institution. It is weak. I would suggest that the cases that have progressed have done so with the support of civil society, with advocacy in relation to the needs for justice. So I would think, unfortunately for you, you are not in the position to drop the ICC because you don't have sufficient other alternatives.
Well, let's take a moment and think about the other alternatives. Because does the ICC preclude us from looking at third country domestic jurisdictions?
Absolutely not. So you have those options, yeah. Certainly. But
because my concern is every time the ICC takes a step that is unauthoritative, actually it weakens the concept of accountability and it weakens the concept of international criminal justice within the public in Libya, but also in the eyes of those that we might be pursuing, that actually in the ICC is sort of self-sabotaging international criminal law, and another failed arrest warrant only emboldens those as opposed to deters them from further action. And perhaps we just say, well, let's not do that anymore. And let's look at things where the bark and the bite match up. Am I too cynical?
You are a bit cynical. That's all right. I think you've earned the right to be cynical. So I don't have an issue with that at all. I see the International Criminal Court more as, let's say, more of an empty vessel that needs to be used in order to become effective, and left to its own devices, states will ensure, states that have an interest in not ensuring justice, which is not all states, but there are a number of states that are not interested in accountability, and they will play havoc on the court, and they will ensure that it dies unless there's a counterweight to keep the International Criminal Court on the map as a possible vehicle for justice. I don't have any illusions. You don't have any illusions. That doesn't mean that we should write it off completely. I think it's part of the toolbox. It needs to stay in the toolbox. And we need to make sure that those states who would prefer not to have it in the toolbox don't succeed.
But then I would say that that's more towards a larger discussion on the international court and international justice. But when we're dealing with the situation in Libya and the realities on the ground and what we want to see, what we want international justice to achieve in terms of not only accountability for the crimes being committed inside, but also as a deterrent, do we put in our efforts? Do we put in the effort and our time, which is very valuable at this point, because we are going down a very dangerous road, or we have already done so, in the impunity that exists inside of Libya today. So, yes, I am a firm personal believer of the ICC and the Rome Statute and everything that it represents, but largely disappointed in the output or the lack thereof on Libya as of today, and would like to now start exploring other options. Do we talk hybrid courts, for example?
I must clarify at this stage that this is part of Marwa's lobbying efforts for a hybrid court. I loved how elegantly you put that into the conversation.
I find it really interesting the way you're asking the question, can we, as if you need permission. You don't need permission. You talk about hybrid courts because it's part, the ICC is not serving the needs in an efficient, easy way. You talk hybrid courts. It's a question of strategy and what one focuses on. I would say keeping us in the topic of criminal accountability, which is where we've somehow, our conversation seems to have drifted to criminal accountability particularly. Think about what's needed for criminal accountability. One, you need to know the suspect, right? Two, there's got to be evidence. Three, there has to be a place for justice to happen. So I want to look at one, two, and then three, because actually one and two, that work can be done and pitched to the variety of courts that may be available or may be in future available to serve the needs of justice. So in terms of investigations, because of the context on the ground in Libya, one needs to think hard about who's capturing the information about crimes, and are those people who are doing the capturing doing it in a way that can be used by international prosecutors, whether those prosecutors are at the International Criminal Court, at a hybrid court, or some other domestic court in Europe or Asia or Africa or the Americas, wherever that court might be. And I think that is the question, the focus on evidence. And then in terms of strategy, who are you pitching it to? I think there's a question. It reminds me, actually, of years and years ago when there was a Rwandan genocide suspect who was found in London, in the United Kingdom. So evidence was collected by NGOs primarily, and an approach was made to the United Kingdom government, please prosecute. But actually, that didn't serve the immediate interests of the United Kingdom government. So the fact that there was a International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda at the time made it easier for the prosecution services to perfect the evidence and then help to transfer the individual to the Rwanda tribunal. So similarly, the ICC is kind of in the background, can potentially be a vehicle for states who may not necessarily have the interest to prosecute, but might be willing to be involved in taking, shaping a case of a person who happens to be on their territory and then sending them on to the International Criminal Court. That would require that the International Criminal Court had an arrest warrant, and it would also require that the state upon whose territory the individual is found has an interest to collaborate in the achievement of justice, wherever that justice happens, which isn't obvious. I remember, it was when the Gaddafi regime was, it was not completely ended, but it was basically ended. And there was a visitor in the United Kingdom. Remind me of the name, Moussa Kosa. So it was quite interesting because that person, there were a lot of, let's say, rumor allegations about potential crimes connected to that person. But somehow the civil society groups, the prosecution services, wasn't really prepared to act in the short time that the person was in the country. And the state, the UK government, wasn't politically in the space or the frame of mind at the time.
No, they were giving him a welcome at the Foreign Office.
Exactly. So given that, if we had another Moussa Kosa situation now, how would we prepare differently? We're here having a discussion with civil society groups, activist lawyers, thinking about how to promote accountability. I imagine some of the audience to this podcast are similarly interested in promoting accountability. How would we have a different situation dealt with in relation to that case or a similar person coming to London?
So that's talking more on the concept of around universal jurisdiction and crimes that, but I think Marwa's lobbying efforts are around sort of a special tribunal type setup, right?
So we have the universal jurisdiction that we can look at and pursue in the end. Then you have the ICC, but I'm thinking more of a court of some sort. I mean, we can imagine it as we want, using the Libyan criminal code, but sitting in another country. Would it be a mixture of judges, Libyan judges and international prosecutors? I don't know.
Well, there's a number of different options for that. Mm-hmm. I can think of the court that was set up after the terrorist bombing, which involved the Lockerbie incident, so there was a court set up in The Hague following Scottish law and involving a Libyan defendant. So that is one example of something that could be put in place potentially, but if we think about the other hybrid courts that have come into play, the special court for Sierra Leone, the extraordinary chambers for the courts in Cambodia, those were brokered, negotiated with the UN, United Nations operating or giving its good offices to help with some kind of an agreement and providing a lot of support behind the scenes. So in order to proceed with that kind of approach, I think it would be really important to get the support of the United Nations to see that that kind of an approach would be helpful, and then look at, well, is this the kind of court which could possibly operate in Libya? Probably not, given the security situation. Where would be a good place for it to be held? What would be the scope of the crimes that this kind of court would look at? How can we ensure that there is a budget to satisfy the needs of the court, to ensure that victims are protected and feel like they can come and testify before the court and then go back home? These are the real questions. First step, I would say, is to engage at the highest possible levels with the United Nations to see if there will be that kind of support, and ensure that there is a range of states around. Another example, and I want to raise this example because it also is relevant for Libya, is the African Union. The African Union was very much involved in supporting the trial in Senegal of Hissène Habré. A whole court was set up behind that process, which quite effectively ensured that there was justice, criminal justice, in relation to that particular case. The issue of reparations is still an ongoing challenge, but nonetheless, the African Union played a relatively useful role in being a vehicle for that court to be established, with a range of governments, additional governments outside of the African Union, providing financial and other political support.
But that's exactly why the hybrid court was introduced with the "Can we talk hybrid courts?" Because recognizing that it will take a profound amount of political will in order to then put in the resources financially and whatnot to establish and keep it and maintain it until we reach, we meet the end of its mandate. And that's not going to happen with us sitting talking today, or with unless there's a massive mobilization towards this and there is a political will. And let's face it, that is really the bottom line. We can't get an international investigative body from the Human Rights Council, because at this point in time, there is a largely perceived notion that any form of accountability will derail the political process.
And actually, before we get to that, because I think that is a key point I want to make sure we touch on today, as I listen to this hybrid court conversation, the question I can hear people asking us is, well, what problem does that fix? Because it feels like it's doing the same thing that the ICC is doing, right? So what is the problem that we're facing that only a hybrid court can fix, that modifying the ICC's mandate can't?
Well, we want the ICC to continue carrying out the work that it does. But number one, the ICC has been investigating the crimes committed in Libya over the past, since its mandate in 2011, its jurisdiction. And we go back to what we said earlier, which is there's only been two arrest warrants for the same person on evidence that was on social media. So there have, the ICC has been largely restricted in terms of their investigations on the ground over the past few years because of the security situation as well. And then at the end of the day, they will look at international crimes, so crimes against humanity and war crimes. If, let's say, we speak hybrid court, Libyan criminal code.
But is that really the standard we would want?
Well, the ICC is not going to go after every single, small scale perpetrator, right? They will go after the big fish, but everyone else who's carried out other crimes that should warrant accountability, the ICC is not going to go after. But in a hybrid court, which if you were in Libya today and you had a judicial system that was functioning, you would be able to go and seek reparations of some sort for being kidnapped or for being unlawfully detained, or that you would not necessarily meet the threshold at the level of the ICC.
So that's a model which can work. And in some cases, international support is given to those instances by way of judges or personnel or training, or in order to deal with the international character of the crimes. But the problem, I suppose, is the political will of the or ability of the government in Libya to put that in place now.
I think the biggest problem, and this is why the hybrid court is, I mean, we're suggesting this, or I am suggesting and a major advocate for, because it would have to sit somewhere else. One of the main problems with the judiciary today is not just that judges are lazy or they don't want to. They have been, judges and lawyers and prosecutors all alike have been targeted by armed groups and militias for pursuing, looking into criminal procedures. You can't even get the general prosecutor to issue a visitation to those held by armed groups in recognized detention centers. And so it is the hijacking essentially of the country by armed groups and militias that have left zero space for the judiciary to function and for the pursuit of accountability inside of the country. So therefore, we can use Libya's criminal code, but we need to take it outside of the country, set it up somewhere else, and then pursue justice.
This feels like a whole other episode, but whether the Libyan criminal code is a standard we would want to apply is something that raises concerns for me.
I mean, that is very much another conversation to be had in terms of legislative reform and going through all of that. But I'm not going to freeze justice and accountability based on the fact that our criminal justice is not up to standards.
It's a really sensitive question, though, that you would probably need to come back to. I can think of some cases where the use of the death penalty would significantly, I wouldn't say invalidate, but undermine the validity of the process, which can be a really sensitive and problematic issue. Here I can think of the trial of Saddam Hussein and the Bangladeshi experience of prosecuting war crimes allegations. In both those instances where the death penalty was on the table and used, the validity was at least questioned internationally.
But again, I would leave the war crimes to the ICC on Libya. Crimes against humanity, the war crimes, meeting that threshold. But there has to be a system that would allow to fill the gap where the ICC is not going to look into, and the crimes that are being committed on a smaller scale.
So I'd say watch the space as we develop this idea. But I think it does raise a lot of interesting questions about not only conceptually if it's the right thing or a interim solution, but also do we then end up giving legitimacy to a legal system that we've actually been advocating to change? So I think it's worth us, this is a good cliffhanger for listeners for future episodes. One of the things that came up quite a few times is this concept of political will. And I want to pick up it in the context of something that was said, which is actually there's no political will really for accountability at all in Libya, because it's seen as something that might compromise the political settlement that people are striving for. So this is the absolutely most boring law school question you're ever going to get of a sort of peace versus justice. I can't believe we're still talking about this, but is there any credence in saying that accountability can be an obstacle to transitional justice or to a political settlement?
I'm a pretty pragmatic person when it comes to this. I don't think that... I think people have a right to have a discussion which is based in reality as opposed to simply something which is completely idealistic and not grounded in anything else. The political will issues exist both in Libya but also outside of Libya. So the idea that justice is going to happen in the absence of political will, it's just not. So what's important is the collection of evidence and finding the levers to impact the political will, to shift it, which is very difficult for civil society to do, but not impossible. If I think of when Auguste Pinochet came to London to have an operation in his later life, there was no political will to see him prosecuted. The last thing the government wanted was to see him prosecuted. He was a very close friend of Margaret Thatcher. There was no interest whatsoever. It was the victims and civil society groups supporting the victims who started lobbying, who started collecting evidence, who worked with lawyers to develop the case. And that is what resulted in the United Kingdom justice system taking on this issue, not because they wanted to, but because somehow there was a bit of space and a bit of recognition that if the courts were not put to the use of justice, that would be more problematic. So somehow it was that loss of face of justice, which played a role in ensuring that you did get a modicum of justice, which then had an impact back home in Chile. So there, it was a ping pong effect where one small thing impacted another, and it was a cascade effect where eventually you had some justice because victims demanded it and required it. But it wasn't easy. And political will was a problem, but there were ways in which to chip away at certain aspects of political will to get some kind of movement.
So let's look at the situation we're in now in Libya. So there is a UN-led political process that was brought to a halt because of the advance on Tripoli in early April. And instead of talking about holding those actors, so General Haftar and his army, accountable for that, or trying to find some kind of, justice for the victims of that, actually the talk is much more about, well, how do we get him back to the table? Or how do we get that process back on track? And so I guess in my mind, is that an okay price to pay for a quote-unquote political settlement? Or do we say, actually, there are some lines here and those who are to build Libya's future should not have been part of the damage caused in its past? And I think for me, that's kind of that's the tension we're contending with. And I, obviously the idealist in me has a very clear view on this. I haven't quite developed my pragmatist side, but I think it's a really difficult question of whether, you know, I mean, there's a lot of talk of amnesties on this, in this process to move the process along, and amnesties for very severe crimes. And is that something that we accept, and accept the narrative that accountability is an obstacle to this settlement or peace? Or do we say that actually it's a prerequisite to this settlement and this peace, that people who aren't held accountable for committing grave war crimes shouldn't have a place at the table?
It's a Friday afternoon. These are very difficult questions. My dear Elham, where should we start with this? I would say that it would be quite problematic for an organization like Lawyers for Justice in Libya to start entering into the pragmatism of political settlements, which do not include justice components, at least a modicum of justice components. How strong one advocates or advocates against, I think one can pick and choose one's battles, but at the same time, one needs to think carefully about how much one can support, given the fundamental principles upon which an organization like yours and is framed. So that would be the very basic thing. Now, what would one do? I think there are there examples? I'm trying to, in Sierra Leone. Okay, sorry, I keep digressing to other situations because the Libyan situation is probably the most complex, but I am going to say this anyways. So Sierra Leone, the UN was involved in a pretty lousy peace agreement, which involved an amnesty. And the Sierra Leone conflict was very, very bloody and very graphic in terms of the kinds of abuses, and it was horrible. Everyone wanted it just to end. And the peace agreement did basically have a role in really ending that conflict, so that was good. Luckily, justice process, there was this special court that was set up, and one of the first cases that came to the special court for Sierra Leone, the Calon case, was about this guy who said, well, listen, I understand you want to prosecute me for these things, but I should benefit from an amnesty. And the court was really good in saying, okay, well, there was this domestic amnesty, and maybe we didn't, you know, maybe the international community wasn't so loud in going against it, but amnesties are not part of the international community's arsenal of justice. And we at this International Criminal Court do not base our system of law on amnesties. So we respectfully decline to take into account the domestic amnesty. And I think that's quite important in terms of time. So you may have a process, but that process means that if this guy travels, another court, it cannot take into account a local amnesty. And a UN body, or if you have a special court in due course, cannot take into account the amnesty.
Well, with that hopeful note, that includes both the disregard of amnesties and your special court, Marwa.
My hybrid court.
Your hybrid court. This, you know, this podcast is called Libya Matters. And so I guess my question for you at the end of our chat is, why does accountability matter?
Accountability matters because Libyans matter, and Libyans deserve accountability. I think it's as simple as that. You as a Libyan deserve accountability. That's why it matters.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. This will help us get discovered and keep growing. If you would like to suggest any guests or topics for future episodes, please let us know on our Facebook page, Libya Matters, or tweet us at Libya Matters Pod. This episode was hosted by Ilham Saoudi and myself, Marwa Mohammed, produced by Tariq Amiri. The people who put it all together are Linda Patumi, Ilham Saoudi, and myself, Marwa Mohammed, along with our interns, Marianne Souze and Ahmed Madi. Libya Matters is made possible by our partnership with International Media Support, IMS. Thank you for listening to Libya Matters. Tune in next week for a new episode.